This is Seattle, Washington, January 9, 1980. This is side one, the first part of two tapes, a discussion between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, research analyst, University of Minnesota Labor Education Service, and myself, concerning the Minneapolis General Drivers' Strikes of 1934.
Hello.
Mr. Maloney.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning. This is Chris Miller.
Yes, I understand.
Okay, how are you?
Well, we're snowed in here this morning.
Snowed?
Oh, yeah, we have been for a couple of days.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah, we had quite a storm, and of course, being a Minnesota truck driver doesn't bother me too much, but it sure bothers here. You know, they're not set up to handle any snow.
So are you really housebound?
Oh, I'm not, but most people are. They've shut down all the schools for 2 days, and the University of Washington's been down for a couple of days, and it's quite a problem here.
God, that sounds awful.
Oh, it isn't awful. You had blizzards in Minneapolis and in Michigan.
Oh, yeah, I know, but I'm thinking of people who don't know what to do with that.
Well, that's true. And then it's a very hilly city.
Uh-huh.
And most of the people have no concept of driving in snow and on top because they've never done it. They don't anticipate the other fellow, and they are very discourteous, you know. They see you trying to negotiate a hazardous piece of ground, they're going to come up and challenge you for the right-of-way.
Boy.
So they enter intersections when they shouldn't, all sorts of things that are wrong, but...
Yeah, they're going to learn the hard way, aren't they?
Yeah, well, what they do here, you know, they figure it happens every once in a while, they'll have one of these big calamity-type things, and it paralyzes things for a couple of days, but they figure that's cheaper than snow removal and buying all the equipment and all this, that, and the other.
Great. I bet the people whose cars get wrecked don't feel that way.
Huh?
I bet the people whose cars get wrecked...
Oh, my goodness, no. I have a friend of mine that lives in Kent. That'd be the equivalent, 18 miles from the city center, like Osseo, and took him 5.5 hours to get home, and most of that's on the freeway.
Oh, lordy.
Yeah.
That's awful.
It is. Well, it's one of those things, you know. We can't do nothing about the weather.
Guess not.
We can talk about it, but that's all.
Well, I want to thank you for the articles that you sent. As I have in the past, I've shared with the other members of the far-right material, and Duffy was pleased to see your stuff on Joe Hill.
Yeah.
And I particularly was interested in the Mormons, the articles on the Mormons.
Mm-hmm.
But the information about them never ceases to amaze me.
Oh, it's scandalous what those people do in the name of the cloth.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they're vicious. And they're mixed up in all sorts of business enterprises. And boy, their labor policy, it stinks.
Mm-hmm.
It's from something else.
But one of the points that interested me was that even though I knew that they were a religion that was indigenous to the United States, I didn't realize how closely they tied their religion to the U.S. Constitution, or how they claimed to. Praying for the security of the U.S. Constitution. Their whole religion is so intertwined with government, the American government. I never really realized that before.
Who was it said the scoundrels last resort is patriotism?
Mm-hmm. Well, boy, that's certainly been incorporated into their belief system. The whole.
No.
Their perception of government and what it ought to
do. Oh, boy, and they are not a bit backward about it either. And if you stop and take a look at some of the bad things that have been negotiated in Congress, and you look out where these senators come from, if they're not from the Deep South, they're from Utah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy, the Hatch and a few more of these guys that are real 18-carat scoundrels, and they're ranking pillars in the Mormon Church. I meant to ask you, I don't know if I sent you along the items on the shutting down of the lumber worker here and that girl had won that victory.
Yes, you have.
And there was a couple of items, I don't know if I included them, about where some girls have sued the shipping lines here and have collected...
No, I didn't get those.
Well, I'll put them in the mail. I thought I overlooked them.
Yeah, no, I didn't get those. I was real interested in your Bechtel, the thing about the Bechtel Corporation that you sent.
Yeah, that's another... you know, people, most people don't realize what goes on in this country.
No, they don't.
They think everybody that goes to Mass on Sunday with their prayer book are nice, beautiful people. That's just a facade. I also asked you a question, and I'll propound it now.
Okay.
I came across some time ago a out-of-print, and this is for Professor Duffy's interest, about the history of the lumber division of the IWW. I don't know if he'd be interested in it. If it is, I'll kick it along to him.
Well, shall I ask him about that?
I thought I put a note in, but... But if not, I can send it, yeah.
I don't know if I saw that note.
Yeah.
I don't recall that. He did look at material. I don't know. Is it a heavy thing? Is it a big thing?
Oh, no.
Well, why don't you send it along?
Because yeah.
Then he might... My thought was that he...
You know, no newspaper is older. It's been read.
Yeah, okay.
Hmm?
Okay. We're going to have to stop in about an hour on this conversation.
Fine.
If it's okay with you.
That's all right.
So why don't we get started talking about...
I want to ask you one question more.
Great.
On the question of the trucks and the hazardous materials and the role that is going on, you got that?
Yes, I did. And it was interesting that you sent that because I had just read that very day another article in a journal that comes out of Detroit. I think it's called News and Notes.
Mm-hmm.
Not something like that. And there are a lot of articles in this. In this particular periodical from dissident groups.
Yeah, that's who those people were. They were some sort of left-wing politicals years ago that started that sheet.
Oh, okay. But they were talking about the very same study that was talked about in the article you sent about the truck drivers. So I had these two different sources for the same piece of information, and it was pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, my comments are this, and very briefly. Most of the drivers I talk to are quite willing, not quite willing, but are reluctant to make a complaint to the employers because the unions don't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if the union wanted to really take them on and say, hey, the trucks don't roll, you got to straighten them up, it wouldn't take long, and they would not eliminate all the problems. But the fleet driver, the driver under union contract who's got the protection, should be afforded that protection. It's been in the contracts. We put it in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have to take them out if they're not roadworthy.
Yeah.
But those are things that we talk about. Let's get on with what your problems are.
Let me ask you one question about that. Why? What is it that prevents the unions from enforcing the contract on that issue?
Well, mostly it's their cozy relationship that they establish with the employers. And another thing is this laborious machinery of grievances. And instead of dealing with them, they get it into what they call grievance. That's a kind of an acronym for everything else. And I make a complaint today about something and the employer says no, and rather than adjudicate the matter directly, they fall back on the apparatus that's in the contract that allows them to process grievances at a top level. And they waltz them away from the barn and on from the road, and they get them like Chicago or San Francisco or Cleveland or someplace when they have grievance committee meetings 90 days hence. And nothing happens to it. Second, they're operating on the three-letter principle in all the locals, that if the employer writes three letters on you, the fourth letter is your dismissal. And so the guys are like the old bank robber who said he was worried about the bonds law getting a third conviction, you go to jail for life. you don't worry about the third one, don't get the first one. Well, I think that's the reason. The men just don't seem to have any faith in the union. They just don't feel that the top leadership, the bureaucrats in the union, are going to do them any good. Now, they just had a very upsetting thing over here in Spokane, the second largest city. I read in the paper here, they turned all the officers out. That's a big local, about 3,000 men.
They turned all of the officers?
The whole bunch of them.
Oh, boy.
And I know that the TDU, that's the Teamsters for a Decent Union, have some active people over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if that's the reason or not. But that's small talk compared to what we want to talk about today.
Well, okay, then let's get to it. Where should we begin?
Well, we ended, my notes show, that we ended talking about Harry DeBoer.
Right.
And we were not through with him.
That's right. You had some more you wanted to say about him.
Now, Harry served as the, I don't know exactly what all we said in the last conversation. I'm not going to go through it. I think I covered it. Harry served as a, from the time he got out of the hospital, was able to amble around. About February of 35, he went on a kind of a casual basis working for the union. The salary was very nominal because we had very little money. And simultaneous with about the time that Harry started to work for the union, Tobin fired us out of the Teamsters International, expelled us. And I and a few other fellows had been working for the union, too, on a kind of a casual basis. We were getting paid $12 a week or $20 or whatever you could, the funds could afford. We had Mrs. Ness and family the union had to take care of. We had a couple, three office girls that we had to pay. And the rest of us divided up what salary money there was left. Some weeks it was 12. Rarely did we get $20 a week, which we were working for. Now, the scale was a little bit better than that, but we were working for $20 a week because the union was in a state of crisis. And we moved our headquarters from down on 3rd Street up to 257 Plymouth Avenue North, right off of Washington. And, of course, when Tobin fired us out of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, we had problems then within the Central Labor Union. There were certain groups that really wanted to do a job on us, and others that wanted to help us. It was kind of house divided there. And those that wanted to help us were kind of in the closet about it, because with the exception of Elmer Crowell and there was a couple of other guys that Walter Frank, they were outspoken. Now Bob Kramer, the editor of the Labor Review, he professed to be friendly, and he was genuinely friendly. But if you didn't know Bob Kramer, he was kind of like an English squire. Didn't want nothing to disturb his way of life and rock the boat. But he would talk to us, and of course, then we started to republish the strike bulletin about that time. In about March of 35, we started up the organizer.
Did you do it as a daily, or was it a weekly?
No, it come out, we didn't do it as a daily. Hell, we didn't have the funds. I think we tried to get it out twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was a need for it, there was an on-the-spot thing, because we had to keep the members advised of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if Mickey Dunn was appointed the editor of that at that time. I think it was Dobbs. Memory serves me, it was Dobbs. Well, and then, of course, we were involved in fighting Tobin for reinstatement, not fighting him. We were fighting for reinstatement in the union.
Mm-hmm.
So Harry was on the payroll of the union. Well, when times really got tough, myself and a couple of other fellows, I forget now, could go out and make a few bucks working, where Harry, was, because of his leg and everything, was unable to do that. And so Harry stayed on working for the union. Now, that was a damn tough period of time, because the hours were long and the problems were many, and then about that time our bald-headed friend Cliff Hall showed up again and tried to shoot the union in the back. And so we were having our problems. Harry remained working for the union. And then when Cliff Hall couldn't cut the mustard, so to speak, for Tobin, Tobin sent in a gang of people from Chicago, mostly. There was L.E. Smith, I think his first name was Leonard. There was Nick Wagner, he was from Chicago. There was Joe Bellini. There was Jack Smith. And two or three, a pair of brothers, Eddie and Al Ferrato, who were hoodlums, real, right, straight out in the hoodlums. And they were reported to be tough guys. Well, no matter how tough you are, if you look long enough, there's another guy a little bit tougher, equally as tough, and they found that out. And there were street fights, there were shootings, there were all sorts of problems going on in the union, and we were on limited financial money, and I and a few more of us were able to make as much driving truck a few days a week as the staff was able to make during the whole week. So Harry continued on working for the local. And then, of course, we were also trying to organize the other unions around the country. We were helping them. In Fargo, in Mason City, Iowa, in Albert Lee, Owatonna, St. Cloud, Fergus Falls, we were building what eventually became the North Central Drivers Council.
Was this being orchestrated by Farrell Dobbs?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And of course, now, you want to remember, Farrell Dobbs, in my consideration of the man, he is... I don't know very many geniuses, but he'd be at the top of the list if there were genius lists around, in my opinion. We also had the background thinking of Carl Skogan and Ray Dunn, who were heavyweights when it come to thinking strategy. Mm-hmm. And there was Mickey Dunn and Grant, and our argument was, and it prevailed, we want reinstatement into the union. The reason that we got drummed out for not paying our per capita tax was that we had about $50,000 worth of immediate local debts to creditors around the city. We had the welfare of Henry Ness and his family and the Ballor family. And there were several people that were still maimed. There was Ben Kosky and a couple of more that were finding it difficult because of the serious injuries they got during the strikes to be gainfully employed. Mm-hmm. And Harry went along working for the union, and that was a... I think the staff of the union at that time was Bill Brown, George Frozig, Grant Dunn, Farrell Dobbs, Mickey Dunn, and Harry DeBoer. Now, from time to time, there was many of us that would go to work for the union on a, a per diem basis. It wasn't just a one-day thing, but if we needed some work that had to be done and the union could afford it, we got paid. If we didn't, we done it free gratis. Mm-hmm. There was, I think, a larger unpaid, unsalaried workforce around there than there was the salaried ones. And there was no money. And in the meantime, of course, we figured that if we were going to maintain what we started out to do, we had to help the outside terminals. And Mickey Dunn and I and Farrell, we were sent up to Fargo, and we spent about a week or 10 days there. We lost that strike, by the way, up there. That was the old Local 173. We had other beefs going on various places. Mickey Dunn went down to St. Louis to help out the Laclede gas workers. They was on strike there. And we had friends here and there. So Harry, all during this period, was plugging along, working for the union. In about, the early part of 1936, in the spring, not the early part, but in the early spring, there were big confrontations with what was Local 500. Now, it is true that Cliff Hall was the so-called business agent, but L.E. Murphy was the secretary treasurer, which is the ranking office in the Teamsters, and he more or less directed the efforts of the staff of Local 500. Now, in conjunction with him at that time was Pat Corcoran. Now, Pat was a big, handsome man. He weighed about 220 pounds, I'd say. He was about 6'2". He was a milk wagon driver. He was the secretary treasurer and business agent, I believe, of the Milk Wagon Drivers Union, Local 471. And he was a power in the Teamster Joint Council. And he was giving a lot of aid and comfort to Cliff Hall. Well, somewhere along the line, he and Farrell and Ray got into discussions, and there were open fights on the streets. There were gunfights. People were shot, and Ray and Frozig and these guys were beat up down at the various terminals, and they weren't alone. In the meantime, of course, we had the Struckware strike. So there was all sorts of activity going on which welded the drivers' union, Local 574, to the hearts of the American worker in the city of Minneapolis in the Central Labor Union. And as much as some of their phonies, and that's the only way I can describe them bastards, wanted to speak out against this, they were overwhelmed by the support because we supported them all. And although we were not members of the Central Labor Union, we did have a policy committee, and Carl Scoglin was the chairman of that. And we were not going to be used by people to set up little sweetheart agreements for them to collect dues. And we had one big fight at Chippewa Springwater. I don't suppose they're around anymore. They used to be a big water deliverer. They used to deliver water all around the town. And we had a big confrontation there one morning, and I believe that was kind of the turning point. That was about April or May of 1936. And then some sort of summit negotiations were being carried on between mostly Ray Dunn and Farrell Dobbs and Pat Corcoran. Now, I suppose Scoggie was in there too, because they were all pretty close. And out of it came some solid thinking by Pat Corcoran, and I'm sure it was Dobbs who convinced Pat of the logic of straightening out the problems. And all that we wanted was to organize the drivers. So on that basis, Pat Corcoran started to be a kind of a missionary in the ranks of the IBT, and helped pave the way for Tobin to reconsider his action. Now, I don't think if you go through the history of the Teamsters International Union, from the day that Tobin took over from Cornelius Shea, you will never find a local which had been expelled from the Teamsters Union where the officers and many of the members were specifically written out of the union under the threat of death. They would never be able to belong to the Teamster family again. It was rechartered and brought back into the Teamsters Union. I don't think you can dig and find that out. Now, you can find out where they've restructured locals on the receivership basis. But this was not that, Chris.
Yeah, this was the original.
This was an equal amount of people from 574 with an equal amount of people from 500, with Pat Corcoran being the impartial person. I don't think there's a case before or since in the history of the Teamsters Union that compares with that record.
That's really something.
And it goes to the logic of what was being done. And I say that Pat Corcoran should be given his day in the sun for that. Because he was largely convinced that the Teamster Union would do better with the likes of us in it than with us out of it. Because I believe that Pat, while Pat was a bullheaded Irishman, which is one of the traits we hold dear, you know, being bullheaded, and he fought us at every turn of the road. He was probably one of the most outspoken people at the beginning. The patriot of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters was uppermost with Pat Corcoran. But once, and I'm sure it was that cold, analytical, perspective logic that Farrell was able to set out that convinced Pat that the Teamsters Union had much more to gain by burying the hatchet and starting out anew. And history proved it. Unfortunately, Pat never saw much of what was to come of that. He was assassinated just before Thanksgiving in November of 1937.
Boy, this is quite a story. Huh? This is quite a story that you're telling.
It's not a story, it's the truth.
Well, yeah, I know. It sounds like a drama is what it sounds like. I have a number of questions I'd like to ask.
Oh, you go right ahead.
If I can.
Yeah.
The one that's first on my mind is right now is, without someone like Pat Corcoran playing the role that he did, do you think 574 ever would have been reinstated?
I think so. It wouldn't have come as dramatic as it did. It probably wouldn't have come as soon as it did, which might have more or less had some effect on the later development of the North Central Council and what is now the Central Conference of Teamsters.
Sure.
I don't think we could have been stopped, because you want to remember, one of the things that convinced Pat was the support that we had built with these other people in the smaller towns. And we were organizing around them. And Carl Skoglund says, we will surround them with a ring of unions. And I can remember his remarks. And we had, not only in Minnesota, we were over in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, up in Superior, up in Duluth. And
that was quite a drive you were making.
Yes, and we had some strong resistance down in northern Iowa from a couple of the people there, but it was just a question of the people having the logic and the theory and the thinking to work it out.
It sounds as though this whole process was clearly confrontation oriented. That is, there was violence. There were people shooting at one another. There were hoodlums brought in from another town.
We didn't start the violence. We defended ourselves.
Okay, but then Pat Corcoran was assassinated and so forth.
Yeah, and Bill Brown was assassinated.
Uh-huh.
A few months later.
So it seems to me that what was going on then must have been absolutely horrifying to the community here. to the authorities here. How did that affect your ability to move about? You must have been blamed.
Oh, we were accused of everything.
But
it's pretty hard to accuse you of starting a fight when two or three fellas jump on you and club you almost insenseless and leave you there.
But that doesn't mean it wouldn't happen, that you wouldn't be accused.
No.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is that the community who did not associate themselves with the working class or with labor, along with the authorities, must have viewed very negatively everything that was happening within the Teamsters organization.
I don't think that's a clear assumption.
No. Okay.
I think I've touched on this before. I think you or Professor Duffy propounded the same question. And I have told you, and I will say again, that there were a good many people in Minneapolis who are not in the overall class, and I mean that by working clothes. They were not in the overall class of people. They were middle-class people. They were people that did not toil with their hands directly as a laborer, but who were involved in one degree or another in the labor market, who were so incensed with the unfair treatment of the working class, and it was dramatized by the efforts that the driver union made to expose it. And these, the people in Minneapolis were aware. I think I've touched on the question of the demonstrations for the relief people, the decentralization of the relief councils, and the pork chop riots that were going on. And there was an era that I don't think the people were provoked at the drivers' union as so much as one would believe, because our role was one of defense. Now, we had been in the forefront of some very outstanding news quite a bit in the summer of 34. And when the strike was over, most people, I believe, felt that, well, now it's over, we can get back to work. And we went back to work, and we were living up to the agreement, and we were maintaining our position. And I'm quite sure that in your talks with the various employers around Minneapolis, they will say about the leadership of that union that they were firm, they were almost daring in some of the things they'd done, but above all, they kept their word and were responsible people. One thing they never, and I don't think you will ever say during that period up till 1941, that anybody run around with a handout trying to shake any employer down.
Mm-hmm.
That was not evident
mm-hmm.
in the Minneapolis labor movement. So I don't think that your assumption that the people were appalled at what was going on, they were aghast that the city administration would permit such scandalous things. Because, you know, during this period of time, there was the Strutmore strike. There was the Flower City Ornamental Iron strike, where people were shot in their own homes because of the reckless firing of guns by the police, and the bringing in of strike breakers in that strike, and housing them in the plant, and tear gassing the whole neighborhoods, shooting people on getting off of streetcars, not deliberately, but just firing at random. There was enough around the people to realize that the people that were not making a living were making an effort to get a little better share of the pie, and that they were right in doing what they were doing.
Well, I can see, though, Mr. Maloney, how someone who was observing, perhaps somewhat sympathetically even, the position that the Teamsters were in during the summer of 1934, looking down very harshly upon what was happening for the Teamsters in 1935. In other words, what they might say is, you know, my God, you've made these gains, and now within your own house, you can't even have any peace. You're fighting each other, there's internal warfare, and I can see those kinds of criticisms being made, and I
Well, no.
If they were being made.
Well, they were being made unquestionably. But here come again the power of the press. The organizer was continually putting out the answers. And they were explaining what was going on. Now, and again, there may have been some degree of reason for your thinking if it were that it was just a polarized fight between the drivers. But the whole community in Minneapolis was still fighting, and we shouldn't overlook that.
I see. So what you're saying is that
there was just a continuation of 1934 where the worker was the underdog.
Okay. So that the feeling that people had in 1934, that is that the Teamsters, the workers, were the underdogs and they were finally beginning to gain some ground, is a feeling that stayed with the community into the struggles that followed.
Oh, yes, and there were big struggles. My goodness, as I think here as you propound questions, there was the big fight with the Northern States Power to unionize the line workers.
Mm-hmm.
The fight at Flower City. The fight at that outfit making the gloves. The big fight over there. And these were dramatic fights. Here was a bunch of women trying to get a little bit more money for what they were doing. The strutwear strike. And in all these roles, it was the drivers who were helping the people fight. So the role, I believe, was that no matter how much the employers would have liked to propound and project, not propound, but project the thought that you raised, that the people were getting enough of this, it wasn't just the drivers that were involved. It was more and more the working class of Minneapolis that were coming to the fore now. The big fights out to Sears Roebuck to organize them and their warehouses and the strikes they had or some more. There was a very hectic period in Minneapolis. And 1934 did not end the problem. It ended it for the drivers temporarily. They had an agreement. But because the drivers got a contract, and because they broke through the open shop rule of the Citizens Alliance, other workers says, by God, they done it, why can't we? And the drivers' union was there to help them at all times. There was no question about, well, have you got the blessing of your international? Have you went through all the chairs of the church? Have you made all the stations of the cross? And have you done everything and all the dots across? Most of these people were new people to labor unions. Many of them had little or no experience, and they knew that by withholding their labor, they might gain a little better, and if they lost the job they had under the conditions they had it, they didn't lose much.
Well, I think you've pointed out something very important, because it's really easy to isolate events in history and look at them in that context of isolation instead of relating them to what else is happening at the same time. And I think it is important to know that there were other strikes going on and, in the city and in the area at the time to which 574 was lending a hand. And that it's also important to know that the community had an ongoing, unbroken sense that a particular struggle was being engaged in.
Yeah, the citizens of Minneapolis, I told you before, there's a good deal of culture in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense of awareness of the people. Most of the people are home people. And they are aware of their responsibility to the community, and they're aware of their responsibility to their obligations to their family and so on, and they wanted a little better shake out of what they were getting in life than was coming down to them. And it was an ongoing thing, and it wasn't just that the drivers were carrying on a street war a la Chicago, where we threw bombs in the buildings and blew out the people and come and picked up the remains the next morning and said, now you're going to go along, son of a gun. It wasn't that way. Everything was done on an honorable basis. It was explained in the organizer, and the union was in the middle of this all the way through. and the fights for the federal workers, the people that were on relief, and there was a good many of them still on relief, you know. And not only was 34 behind us, but the recession of 36 was on its way, too. Now, we got away from Harry DeBoer, but go on with your questions.
Yeah, we did get away from Harry DeBoer, but I think that that was one of the main things that concerned me, the extent to which the community was responding in a negative way, and whether or not that had any impact on whether or not 574 would ever get back into the Teamsters Union.
Oh, there was big effort made to keep us out. You're absolutely right in that assumption. And secondly, you have to be right in the assumption that there was efforts being made, and serious effort by the press, by the media, to portray the whole fight in Minneapolis as a gangster fight, but it just didn't wash. It didn't take. I can't recall where there was great vigilante moves. And besides that, there was something else that was happening. There was something else that was happening. And this, hello.
What was that?
That was the fight that was going on with the far right. William Dudley Pelley and L.K. Smith and these far right people. And we were fighting that too. No one wanted Hitler's fascism. And the Drivers Union played a big role in that too. And William Dudley Pelley, the Silver Shirts, Fritz, what was his name, the organizer of the Bund. Oh, there was a pro-German movement, the pro-Italian.
Minneapolis, that was happening?
What?
That was happening here in Minneapolis?
Oh, yes, and it was happening nationwide. And that was one of the reasons why we organized our defense guard in the Union. They were threatening to come and rub the Union out, and they were getting big publicity. They had the Minneapolis Armory chartered.
Why?
Oh, and these were things, you see, that had it been just an isolated one union in a community fighting a fight between a bureaucratic overlord and the more or less rank and file, whatever you say is on, it would have aroused the people while they're having a big goddamn internal feud, a family fight.
Mm-hmm.
How's your tape?
Well, we've got a couple more minutes. Do you need some water?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't you get some water and I'll flip the tape.
All right.
Seattle, Washington, January 9th, 1980. This is side one of the second part of two tapes. A discussion between Professor Martin Duffy and Christine Miller, research analyst, University of Minnesota, Labor Education Service, and myself concerning the Minneapolis General Driver Strike of 1934.
I'm a man of the world.
he just died a month or so ago.
Yeah, he was a long-winded guy.
Yeah.
And he had that Leon Earle, a member of the Screen Actors that was disciplined, I think, or what I call it, by the reprimanded, at least by the Screen Actors Guild, for hustling money for, he built that with scab labor, you know, 40 cent an hour labor, that Capitol man at Royal Oak. But that group was around, and that kept Minneapolis agitated.
So most of the people in Minneapolis were very turned off by this this new right movement.
Yeah, and it was concentrated, you know, in Minneapolis because the Citizens Alliance were fighting to maintain their supremacy, and they were using all of this stuff to come and cook things up, and I believe that it was wrong. And these guys didn't move around, you know, without they had the area orchestrated. They don't want to come in and get losers, and we put the chase to them. And I do it again. I don't believe in fascism or anything else like it. And so the union played a good role there, and the people knew that. Now, so when finally, now we go back and pick up for Harry.
Okay.
When the peace talks were a certainty, which was in about last part of July, early August, 36. We were back in to the Teamsters Union, I think, by September of 1937. Now, all the things that we had been doing in what we called a kind of a stepchild or sub rosa manner, we suddenly were able now to do with the blessings of the International Union. Now, we weren't any more stepchildren. Now, in the process in Minneapolis, as a result of the 1934 strike, there were other areas of driving activity that had not been neglected, but that were in the area of 574. And one was the bakery wagon drivers. Another was 125, the cab drivers. Another was the city and sanitary drivers. I think that was 664. And the ice and coal wagon drivers of 221. Now, as I told you, I believe in the first conversation we had, I outlined the history a little bit of the coal drivers. Now, with the exception of Cedar Lake Ice and Coal, and Hawthorne Fuel, and one other company, all the coal drivers were in 574. So we had a big coal section. On the other hand, we had 221, and George Guider, who was the business agent, had been, I don't know, he was also a city councilman, he was in the third ward there, George Guider, his name was, and he had a beer joint up on Lindale and Lowry.
He sounds like a busy man.
Well, he was an entrepreneur. He was on three or four payrolls, you know. He was about, he was much more adept than Cliff Hall. He had much more on the ball, too. And that ain't saying much, because Cliff Hall had nothing. Well, the reorganization of some of these unions took place. The bakery wagon drivers union, we had the bakery wagon drivers union, and the union was very immense. Now, you want to remember there's about 7,500 men in it very quickly. And we had one general business meeting a month, and we had section meetings for each union, each craft in the union, like the coal haulers one night and the bakery drivers the next and so forth. Well, it was decided that maybe, perhaps, to deal with this thing more directly, we could organize and set up, not to dismember Local 574, but to deal with a field that we were meeting resistance in, because, well, you guys ain't truck drivers, you're commission drivers. So Local 289, the Bakery Wagon Drivers Union, I believe, was chartered about that time. Also, the warehouse union, which led the strike at Sears Roebuck, was chartered about that time. Harry DeBoer was the man in 289. They wanted some help and so forth, and when it was organized, Harry DeBoer was the spark plug there, and another driver that was a bakery driver was named Joe O'Hare. And Joe's guy, I don't know, he's retired long since, I suppose, and may be dead by now. Joe was older than Harry, older than I, by a few years, so he's well in his late 70s now. So Harry then became the guy that was the bargainer for the bakery drivers and the commission drivers, and he spent most of his time from 37 in about September, October, in that, whenever that union was reorganized, chartered, reorganized, and restructured would probably be the best way. Harry was the man there. And he stayed that way until the break came in whenever it was, 1940, 41, when Tobin decided to crack down on the union. And in addition to that, Harry, of course, would relegate as much work as he could to the... There was a couple of officials in the periphery of the 289, Joe O'Hare and I think one other fellow, because that became a pretty good-sized local. There's a lot of bakers around town, and commission drivers and various things like that. And Harry found time as well, though, to work with us whenever it was possible in the area organization and negotiations in the more local areas, but he came in and into the central negotiations too, not on the committee, but as a, well, not an observer either, a participant, but not an official member of the committee. Later on in the state apparatus, Harry held a post there, as I recall, when we started to develop the thing on a more state-by-state basis. And Harry participated in the 1938 over-the-road strike, which lasted 22 weeks. He was able to be utilized to help in the highway driving and the organization of the highway drivers and things like that. Well, now that was Harry's role up until 1940, whenever the break came. And he was a participant in 41. While not an official member of the committee, he was a member of the Minnesota group. There were a group, I sent you the members of the group at one time, and you must have that in your file. And Harry was not one of the regular members of the committee, but that did not preclude other people from the state. See, we had a state apparatus set up in each state, and Harry was on it for the state of Minnesota. Him and Mickey Dunn, I believe, were the two from Minnesota. And because they understood the industry and they know what was going on and they knew how to deal with the employer. The employer wasn't going to pull the wool over Harry DeBoer's eyes. No one's coming in there to sell him a pig in a poke. And he was a very valuable man. And he remained that way up until the last days of the Union 544 before it was restructured by Tobin again.
So it sounds as though Harry was in it from start to finish.
He was. He was all the way through, and he played a remarkable role in it. And he's a kind of, like I say, a guy that don't toot his own horn. He doesn't say much about what it does, but I tell you, when the chips are down and you need somebody to be there, Harry will be there. Mm-hmm. And he ain't worried about nothing. And later on, of course, he had a very tragic thing. His brothers had big wheat farms up in the Red River Valley. And after he See, I left Minneapolis in 1937 to participate in the area over-the-road activities. And I was only back in Minneapolis for a few days at a time. A week, 3-4 days. That's about the limit. But Harry was involved, and I went to the Slammer in August of 1940. And, of course, the Union was still in good graces with Tobin. And in the 1940 convention, our delegates there prevented Tobin from getting across compulsory arbitration, which we were always opposed to. And I see it's working its way into so many unions now in the Teamsters. We opposed compulsory arbitration. We agreed to arbitration, and it was mutually agreed. And Harry was one of the group that was involved in the civil rights fight and the Smith Act trials, and he went to prison. And when he came out of prison, his ability to get a job was pretty well down the stream, and he started in as a truck salesman in a used truck lot. And in the harvest time, he went up to help his brothers, and one day he was oiling the, when the machines were shut down, these big combines, he was greasing them, and somehow or other the sleeve of his jacket got caught, and it wrapped his, these things are powered by V-belts, and there's 8 or 10 V-belts, they just about mangled his whole hand, and the doctor was going to cut his hand. Notice it. But the hand is immobilized.
Oh, that is so good.
So Harry's had a life full of trials and tribulations.
On a Wednesday morning from KMBS, AM and FM.
Lots of places where you come to measure a man's mettle, you know. It's one thing to get up and shoot your mouth off someplace, but it's when you got your back to the wall and you got a friend that's there, Harry's there. And he always was. There was a lot of guys like that in Minneapolis. And I'm sure that if you talk to any of the solid citizens,
and everybody else who was close, same open school there on the north, Snohomish County, Edwards, Sultan, Maryville, and Snohomish schools are open an hour late. Santa Falls was open, trying to be on schedule for tonight, but most of the rest of the schools in Snohomish County and Pierce County are closed. The colleges, same as yesterday, Seattle is closed today. Seattle Pacific also is closed.
You've inspired some interest in Pat Corcoran for me, and perhaps we can include him on the list of people that that we're going to be talking about.
Well, now the next one, I've got my question, which would be number 46.
No.
We have Ray Rainbolt,
yes.
Kelly Postle, Fred Snyder, the Dunn Brothers. I assume now you just want to talk about Mickey and Ray and Grant.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Carl Skoglin and Farrell Dobbs and Bill Brown, and then we'll put Pat Corcoran down.
Okay. Do you think you can tell us anything about Izzy Wolk and Joe Spiller?
Oh, okay. I can give you what I know about Izzy Wolk and Morris Swiller. I'm not that intimate with Morris Swiller. I know a little bit about Izzy Wolk. He was the head waiter at the penitentiary when I was there.
Oh, boy. Well, let's see. It's the 9th today. Are Wednesdays so good for you? They're all right.
Fine. Any of these days are good for me. No, wait a minute.
Okay.
I have a crown to be put on my tooth at noon on the 21st of January, I believe.
Okay, that's a Monday.
Let me grab it too. Yeah, that's a Monday, and I'm going in there to get a full crown.
Is that painful?
No. It's painful when you pay.
Yeah.
One of the things we don't have is dental care for pensioners in our contract.
Club is doing the
workforce. $1,200 a year, you know, and you get a $25, $30, $100 thing, and you carry it out over a couple of years. We figure we cover about 80% of it.
Well, that's real good then. Better than not having it. That's
Oh, yes.
Well, what do you say we talk again on the 23rd?
That's 23rd.
Yes, that's a Wednesday, 2 weeks from today.
Yeah.
I'll call you at 11 my time.
Okay? Yeah, it'll be 9 o'clock.
Well, I was sick over the
holidays. Oh, no.
Yeah, yeah.
And did you have your company in?
Yeah, my company in. My sister and nephew, and we had a great time.
Well,
I got over it just as they got here, so it all worked out pretty
well. That's...
How about your holiday?
Oh, mine are always just about the same. There's more activity than you know what to do with. You got a big family, you know.
Uh-huh.
And you're running around from here to there and every place else. I have a sister that had 12 children, another one five, and another one five, and there's
you
all
are
sorts
an uncle.
Of...
Huh? You are an uncle.
Yeah, and... Then they have the children, and somehow they have children, and my God, my brother lives there, of course.
It must be a couple hundred.
Well, that's Yeah, well, he might get a chance. He's 59. He's got hopes, you know.
Yeah.